Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Global climate change is expected to take a significant toll on the North American bird population. The National Audubon Society recently released a report that says nearly two-thirds of North American birds will go extinct if global temperatures increase by 5.4 degrees by 2100. We thought we'd start with the climate change piece and then move on to birds later in the program. Aaron Wilson is a climate specialist and research scientist at the Ohio State University Bird Polar and Climate Research Center. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. It's good to be with you again.
How has climate change manifested in Ohio? Do we see much evidence of it yet?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Obviously, when we look at the polar regions of the world, we see the ice that's rapidly decreasing. And so we often think, what are the changes that are taking place around us? Is there anything that stark? Certainly what we've seen are warming temperatures over the last century, especially during winter. So our winters are really outpacing our summertime increase in warmth, about double that during winter than summer. A lot of the warming is occurring at night during the summer, so we're having warmer overnight temperatures in general. We've seen an increase anywhere in Ohio from 5 to 15% increase in annual precipitation, but those are strongly driven by fall trends and spring trends as well, and still seeing in some locations, flat or even negative summertime trends. So that's changing a seasonal precipitation pattern. And we've also seen an increase in the intensity of the rainfall events, single-day events, multi-day events. So our flooding risk is increased now compared to, say, the mid-20th century.
What do the episodes of increased rainfall have to do with climate change?
Yeah, so as far as, one of the root causes or the things that we're looking at in terms of that precipitation that's increasing is that as temperatures increase, we have more water vapor in the atmosphere. And with that water vapor, whenever we have fronts come through, they're able to wring that moisture out, and those are then increasing our intense rainfall events, as well as an overall increase in the precipitation across much of the Midwest as well.
A lot of times when there's a big snowstorm, and there doubtless will be one this winter, I shouldn't say doubtless, we never know. We've had winters with practically nothing lately. But
sure. But
whenever there is a big snowstorm in central Ohio, there's inevitably someone who pops up on a social media site somewhere saying, wow, global warming, it's really killing us or something like that. What's the difference between that short-term perception and the long-term outlook?
That's an excellent question. It's really, I think, at the crux of society's understanding of climate change is really comes down to the differences between weather and climate. Weather are the short-term, high-frequency changes that we see in our temperature, precipitation, and moisture that's continually happening. We get up this morning, or I would better to think of a clear day. We get up in the morning and say it's in Newark a couple days ago, 28 degrees in the morning. By the afternoon, we're sitting close to 70 degrees, for instance. So we have large swings in temperatures day to day. But when we deal with climate, we're talking about changes over a much longer period. We're not talking about individual events. But one way we can look at it is, are the severity of events increasing? Is the duration becoming longer? Are we seeing heavier rainfalls more frequently, or is the magnitude changing? In other words, are we seeing more 2 or 3 or 4 inch rainfall events than what we saw in the past? And that's how we can identify the changes that we're seeing. So understanding those differences between short-term changes in weather and weather events and our long-term climate change is important. More moisture also means that during the wintertime, we have an opportunity for interaction in the atmosphere to provide heavy snowstorms. We've seen that as well. So we can't just look at single events as the evidence, but really it's the changes in the magnitude and the accumulation of those events over time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The National Audubon Society in a recent report said that if the global temperature increases by 5.4 degrees by the year 2100, 389 species of birds across the continent are threatened. We're talking about climate change itself right now with Aaron Wilson. He's a research scientist at the Ohio State University Bird Polar and Climate Research Center. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Aaron Wilson, the global temperature this decade has increased 1.8 degrees. And a lot of people don't understand how such a seemingly small increase, you know, to lay people affects so much. How does that work?
Yeah, so it really comes down to the feedbacks in the entire what we call the climate system. I mean, again, you think about 1.8 degrees. We get those changes over a matter of a few minutes on a day-to-day basis. But we're talking about moving a needle, over a longer period of time. And 2 degrees is a significant change when you put it into context of the differences between, you know, a lot less ice on Earth and a warmer scenario to one of an ice age in terms of a climate perspective. And so it's often the most difficult piece, I think, of climate change to communicate because we don't think of it as a significant change, just 2 degrees. But it impacts so many things. And so as our temperatures start to, that mean temperature rises, first of all, that means we have an opportunity for more record heat, overnight lows, daytime highs. It means that our icy parts of our world, our glaciers and our ice sheets start to melt, and that water flows off into the ocean, and it contributes to sea level rise. I mentioned the increase in the water vapor. So you have more water vapor in the atmosphere that's available for rainfall and precipitation patterns. So you see all these different connections that take place. Once you start initiating that increase in temperature, we all the other feedbacks that we have in our climate system are very sensitive to those changes, and so that's then starts to increase or compound the impacts both on humans and on wildlife and the environment in general.
Is there a tipping point that climatologists look at with all of this? I know you all hate, you know, The Day After Tomorrow, that movie, which made it sound like it was going to be something super precipitous, and all of a sudden a bunch of boys all over the world would start going off in the oceans. But is there a tipping point? And so you're talking about the glaciers melting. They're not going to refreeze, are they, or could they?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two thoughts that come to mind when we think about tipping points, and there are researchers that are studying whether or not we've surpass the tipping point or what that could be. One is the fact that we do deal with time. We know that, for instance, ice has changed over periods of thousands of years or more, but it's the rapid change that we've seen of late that is really stark. You know, some of the research that Lonnie Thompson here at the center is doing on just the rapid changes that are taking place. So it's really a time thing. It would take a great deal of time to rebuild, you know, the glaciers that we see. The other thought I had in terms of tipping point is that a lot of times tipping points then give us this, I think, what is a false sense of, well, there's nothing we can really do about it. We've now gone past that point of no return. And I don't like to think of it as an on-off switch. I like to think of it more as, what are the outcomes that we are choosing to do as society? What can we do now to adapt, to mitigate, to limit some of the worst outcomes that we know that are going to happen based on what we see? So, yet, while I think tipping points are an important part of that conversation because they can help us then understand ways that we can adapt, I think a lot of times we try to avoid that in the sense that it's too it's too far down the road now. There's nothing we can do about it, and I don't think that's a healthy conversation that we want to have. We want to think about ways to adapt and mitigate to these changes.
A few years ago, I moderated a panel discussion for the Byrd Polar and Climate Research Center at Ohio State about the military response to climate change,
yeah,
particularly the water levels and that kind of a thing. That was very indicative of the concern there is at official military levels for this, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think we've seen, certainly we've seen individual businesses, we've seen the military, we've seen different states, municipalities, for instance, cities in Florida that are rapidly trying to build up resilience to increasing water levels. We've seen a lot of action at local and even state levels, I think, across the country and in other parts of the world as well.
Let's see. Dick in Westerville, you're on the air with Aaron Wilson, research scientist at the Ohio State University Byrd Polar and Climate Research Center. Welcome, Dick. Hello, Dick.
Yes.
Go ahead.
He talks about all this rain, lots of rain,
mm-hmm,
and we have got a mini drought going on in this part of Ohio, which is not a whole lot of difference away from what's Donna in OSU campus. And I'm just wondering, are we talking the same language? Are we talking about the same water? It's incredible to me.
Yeah, address that. Dick's from Westerville. They're not getting enough rain there.
Absolutely.
You know, they got less than, I don't know how, what fraction of the corn crop got in this year across the state because of too much rain.
Yeah, so what this brings up is this idea of high variability, of rapid swings in our hydrologic regimes. And certainly this is an excellent case here in Ohio this year. We had a lot of stations by the end of June that have recorded more than their annual normal amount of rainfall. And then we've got places out in west central Ohio and even parts of central Ohio that have seen less than 5 inches of rain since July 1st. Right, so we're talking about major swings in our hydrologic extremes, and that's one of the signs that we're seeing as well. And like I mentioned at the beginning, we've seen strong spring and fall increases in our precipitation, but not necessarily the same trends during our summer. So we've seen flatter declining trends in some locations in summer rainfall. So that's an excellent point. Overall, yes, we're seeing more water, but the timing of that water is very important as well. And from an agricultural standpoint, when a lot of it is falling on the traditional non-growing season and not on a growing crop, that can be problematic as well. So we need to think about how to adapt to these rapid swings in the hydrologic cycle. And it's an excellent, excellent point.
And are those swings a function of climate change? Maybe I missed that.
Yeah, I mean, they can be, right? So one of the things that we think about are these patterns that we get into over the long term. So while we might have more water vapor in the atmosphere that's providing rainfall, we're also seeing, you know, slower weather patterns or blocking patterns, what we call blocking patterns, that kind of keep dry weather around for a long time. Obviously, there's still research that's being conducted on the causes and shifts of these hydrologic extremes, but basically increasing temperatures, more evaporation at nighttime, as well leading to more water vapor that's being then evaporated into the atmosphere, or water being evaporated into the atmosphere, just changing that hydrologic cycle and that intricate balance between incoming, you know, energy here at the surface and then the water cycle on Earth. So that's the key relationship between climate change and what's happening in the hydrologic world.
Thanks, Dick, for that call. And then we're going to be talking about the impact on birds during the show, but they can't be the only animals affected by the change, right? This is like all whole ecosystems are going to be affected.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, having looked at this new Audubon report, I think it's just another clear example of the scope, really, that climate change plays in our lives. And it shows how connected we are, you know, to our surrounding environments. We often call climate change a threat multiplier. It makes our job harder. So, you know, I think it also makes the natural environment, the plants, the trees, the birds, the wildlife, it makes things like migration and, you know, finding adequate food and shifting timing of when plants bloom and fall springs and things like this make it more difficult for the wildlife as well. And I think this Audubon report just really drives home the fact that we're all impacted and all connected here on Earth.
Aaron Wilson, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Aaron.
Aaron Wilson is a research scientist at the Ohio State University Bird, Polar, and Climate Research Center. Coming up, we're going to talk about birds now, how important they are to Ohio. It's a big migratory place. Birds pass through, but the number of birds passing through are expected to drop precipitously if a 5.4 degree Fahrenheit rise in global temperatures occurs. So stay with us. We'll talk about that. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The National Audubon Society recently released a report that says nearly two-thirds of North American birds will go extinct if global temperatures increase by 5.4 degrees, and that's all by 2100. Nat Miller is the Acting Executive Director of Audubon Great Lakes and Director of Conservation for Audubon's Upper Mississippi Flyway. He joins us by Skype. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Great to be here.
And Michael Goldman is the Conservation and Outreach Manager for Grange Insurance Audubon Center right here in Columbus. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So a study published in Science last month said that already the bird population has plummeted by 2.9 billion breeding adults since 1970. Nat Miller, what in the world has been going on for the last 50 years?
Yeah, that's a scary number, right? That's about one in four birds has disappeared over the last 50 years. And that's primarily been driven by habitat loss and degradation, but other factors as well. And I think one silver lining in that report is that not all species have been driven down. And some, where science has identified the issues, have actually increased. So waterfowl, ducks, and other water birds, as well as raptors, have actually increased their population over that same time period, and that's largely because of some great wetland protections that have happened and the banning of DDT in the 70s that has helped raptor populations. But habitat loss is really the driving factor for those declines over the last 50 years.
Right. I was just looking at somebody's license plate. It had Ducks Unlimited on it. There's all kinds of attention paid to those kinds of things. And that's a big reason why Ohio has remained such a great place up along Lake Erie because of the habitat preservation, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we know birds depend on having their space to breed and eat and seek shelter. And wetland protections and restorations led by a lot of game-focused organizations and hunting dollars has really helped those game species stabilize and even increase their populations.
Michael Goldman, here in Central Ohio, do you notice the change in the number of birds out there?
Yes. Yeah, we see that all the time.
What's the evidence?
Well, a lot of it you can see in your own backyard. There's a lot of people who will come into the Audubon Center and they say, hey, you know, I haven't been seeing these rose-breasted grosbeaks anymore. I saw them, you know, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, and now they're just not showing up anymore when I have my spring feeders out. So these aren't even things that you have to go very far to see. These are things that are all happening in our own backyards.
And that it actually those kinds of counts, right, Nat Miller, they were used in this study that produced these results.
Yes, absolutely. What's great about birds is people love to count them. So including a lot of volunteer collected data, you know, at Audubon, we have a data set that is over 100 years old with the Christmas bird count. And there's breeding bird surveys that are taken during summer across the U.S. and have been for decades. So we really have a good handle on how bird numbers are trending up and down and per guilds of species as well.
You mentioned that waterfowl and raptors, eagles, to wit, in Ohio. I mean, I remember when I traveled 3 or 4 hours to see an eagle's nest up in, some county out in the middle of Columbiana County or something like that. Now, you know, you hear about people talking about them all the time, but that are we putting too much into that, Nat Miller, as far as locally? It looks good when it comes to the waterfowl and the raptors, but there's other things that we're missing, the kind of the birds that hide in the trees.
I think so, yeah. So there's good news in these reports, but there's a lot of bad news as well. And a lot of the birds that were once common are trending downward significantly. So that's the one in four lost over the last 50 years, right? And our new climate report looks at 604 different species across North America that either live here or migrate through, and 389 of those species are at significant risk of extinction because of climate change. So, yes, there are some great success stories and some flagship birds. Raptors are great for that, right? Hawks and eagles and falcons.
Yeah.
But a lot of the birds that, you know, are woodland birds and long-distance migrants or grassland birds especially have really plummeted. And their populations at this trend are not sustainable.
Michael Goldman, do you see any impact of this past spring when farmers were unable to get really most of their crops in because of such because of the rain and too much water? Is there any kind of immediate impact when something like that happens? There is in the farm fields, but does that affect the birds that fly over them?
It absolutely affects the birds that are going to be flying over them. If farmers can't be planting their crops on time, there's a lot of other plants that are not going to be able to grow on time as well. And what we're finding is things that are migrating through Ohio, things that need to stop here, maybe they're not finding those plants that they survive on. A great example of this is our hummingbirds. And if we're having a weird spring, if we're having a false spring and things start blooming and then they die off before hummingbirds can get here, well, that's that whole nectar source for hummingbirds that's just all of a sudden gone. What are they going to survive on? We see this a lot with apple trees. If apples, those flowers, they bloom early in the season. And if it gets too warm, then they're going to bloom a little too early. And then a lot of times we'll have this freeze that'll come immediately afterwards, killing all those apple flowers. And mm-hmm. then we don't have any apples that year.
Is there any sense that that's kind of what's affecting the bees, too? The climate change is the same issue? I mean, they're nectar.
I'd say it's a similar issue.
Yeah.
It's certainly
okay.
A similar issue. Bees need flowers to survive. But more of an issue with the bees is the pesticides that are affecting them.
Mm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. About two-thirds of America's birds, or the American continent's birds, will be threatened with extinction if global warming rises by 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit. That extinction is expected to accumulate over time and reach that level by 2100. That's according to a report released last week from the National Audubon Society. We are talking about the impact in Ohio and the region. We have Nat Miller. He's the acting executive director of Audubon Great Lakes and director of conservation for Audubon's Upper Mississippi Flyway. He's by Skype. And with me here, Michael Goldman. He's the conservation and outreach manager for the Grain Insurance Audubon Center right here in Columbus. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Nat Miller, going back again to the waterfowl point you made, that waterfowl and raptors, they're doing great because of protections and conservation of wetlands. But, you know, I have a cabin up in the Upper Peninsula. The rising levels of the Great Lakes are a great concern. And I'm wondering, could there be too much of a good thing? I mean, we talk a lot of times, people think about the water is, you know, the water tables or I'm sorry, the water levels in association with the coasts. But what about the Great Lakes region? Is there anything to be concerned about there?
Absolutely. I often say to my colleagues on the East and West Coast, not to belittle sea level rise, but in the Great Lakes, we've had to deal with 6-foot water level changes over the last several years. And there's some really good science looking at long-term impacts of climate change on the lake levels. And on average, I think we're going to stay within kind of the historical average or maybe slight declines. But what we're really seeing is a great uncertainty and rapid fluctuations in the short term. So year to year, over 5-year period, we don't really know anymore what that cycle of water levels will be. And that's another place where we got great overlap with what impacts birds, impacts people, right? So our birds that depend on those coastal areas and either beaches or coastal wetlands are going to be flooded out or not have the water there that they need at the right times because that cycle is off. And that in combination with the more intense storms, more flooding that we're seeing in coastal regions is a big impact. You know, piping plover is a great example. It's a small shorebird, federally endangered in the Great Lakes region. And that they were down to just a dozen or so pairs in the 80s. Now they're on their way to recovery, but flooding issues in the coastal areas of the Great Lakes is really jeopardizing their future.
And then I talked with the climatologist earlier who explained that birds, of course, are not the only animals threatened by the climate change. Michael Goldman, you talked about if you don't attract the right the things that birds eat, whether it's bugs or nectar, that's another problem.
Yeah, it is a really big problem. You know, it's not just about them finding, you know, food. It's about what time is that food available.
As they're migrating
through. Or, you know, there's a lot of birds here that that just live in Ohio year round. But if suddenly something happens, like we have a drought or we have big flooding, they're not going to be able to find those normal sources of food that they're depending on either.
And we can't make up for that with our backyard bird feeders, right?
It certainly helps to a degree. But no, what they really need is the natural food, wild food that they're going to be able to find out in forests or prairies.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Nat Miller, I read that the ability to migrate like birds do is actually it's a strength of theirs. It's an asset in terms of avoiding a lot of the impact of global climate change, but it only takes us so far.
Yeah, that's right. So obviously the ability to fly helps our birds in terms of adaptation to climate change. So that was really the heart of our report, looked at the shifting climatic zones for these species. And we're already seeing bird ranges shift to the north because we've already endured about a 1 degree Celsius warming on the planet. So birds are being pushed to new places, and they can get there a little faster by flying, but that doesn't mean that that new place will be suitable for them and have the right habitat and the right competition and new predators, right? So if you think about some of our grasslands in Ohio, you know, there's only so far grassland birds can move north before they hit the lakes and then before they hit boreal forests of Canada. So yes, it does help that birds have that ability to adapt a little bit more. But there's a lot of questions still to be answered about how they actually do in the new climate.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the birding industry and how big it is in Ohio and how important it is. Obviously, Michael Goldman, there's the Grange Insurance Audubon Center out by Scioto, and there's the Greenlawn Cemetery nearby that. This is a huge migratory path. Nat Miller, there's Black Swamp Bird Observatory and all along Lake Erie. It's a big deal. Is there any way to summarize? I mean, just maybe on a local level, Michael Goldman, what are the birding numbers, and what would it cost us to lose so much of that?
Well, I'm going to start by saying that birding in the United States is a $100 billion industry, and that's billion with a B. So this isn't just a couple of people walking around with a pair of binoculars. This is millions of people throughout the United States. It's about 45 million people consider themselves birders. That's one out of every five adults is a birder in the United States. Here in Ohio, we estimate it's about 1.5 million people. Audubon has 1.5 million members. Which is huge. You know, people love going birding. One of the best places to bird in the world even is here in Ohio. It's up by Toledo, the McGee Marsh, by the Black Swamp Bird Observatory. And they'll bring in somewhere between $20 and $40 million every year from their biggest week in American birding. It's one of the biggest birding festivals in the world. And no one even thinks about, like, Ohio being this birder destination, but it really is. And it drives a lot of things in our economy.
Tourism.
It's huge tourism. And we get thousands of people just at our little metro park, the Scioto Audubon Metro Park at the Grange Insurance Audubon Center. But we're just one nature center. Then you can go up to Cleveland. You go to the nature center at Shaker Lakes. It's another important birding area up there. You can go down to the Cincinnati Nature Center. There's all these kinds of places that people have to drive to, which means they're buying gas. They have to buy snacks because who doesn't love, you know, eating snacks while they're birding? Very important. They got to get coffee because, you know, birding happens early in the morning. Got to have your coffee. And then you have to have your newest binocular, and you want to have the newest camera. And so it really is an economic driver, is this bird tourism. And birds really do mean business. They bring a lot of money into all these different areas where normally you wouldn't.
And Nat Miller, I mean, from where you sit, it's huge.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that number of one in five adult Americans consider themselves a birder is incredible. And at Audubon in Ohio, we have 36,000 members, right? That love going birding and also get engaged in protecting these areas. So for us, that's really what we're looking for. And And with this report, I think, you know, it's a reminder that birds have always been, quite literally, the canary in the coal mine, right? They show us what's happening to people as well. But now I think we see birds also as an ambassador for change. You know, our Audubon membership and bird lovers across the country represent a great political diversity. And really, birds are now showing us that climate change is real. It's impacting our wildlife. It's impacting people. And we need to take direct action now if we're going to make a difference. So, you know, again, back to the silver lining of our report is if you mentioned the 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit warning, warming, sorry. But if we can stick to 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit by immediately reducing our greenhouse gases, then we're going to improve the conditions for 76% of those 389 species. They'll no longer be listed as climate vulnerable for us. So, you know, I think a message here is still, yes, climate change is complex, but there is still time for this generation to make a big impact and reduce global warming. And we hope to do that through the broad base of people that love birds and our Audubon members.
Michael Goldman, how much of what you do relates to teaching people about the impact of climate change on the birding on the bird population?
A great deal, yeah. As conservation and outreach manager, I'm always engaging with people, whether it's tabling or via social media, a lot of volunteer groups that come in, and it's always, hey, you know, we're not just doing this, you know, to make this prairie, you know, a healthier place. It's really about these birds, because birds are this tangible animal that are out there. We see them every single day. We see pigeons and we see sparrows. We see these crows and blue jays. These are normal things that we see. And it's so easy to connect all these birds to what we're doing in our everyday lives. You know, it's, hey, you know, how about instead of feeding those ducks bread, which is a terrible thing to feed ducks, mm-hmm. let's just use some rice. Let's do some cabbage or some lettuce, which is going to be a lot healthier for them. I do a lot of bird hikes. I'll lead a lot of bird hikes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it, you know, I have to say, you know, this bird is great. It's here today. And we have to make sure that it's going to be here tomorrow as well.
We'll continue our conversation. I want to drill down a little bit into all the impacts on the different kinds of habitats that are going to be affected by climate change going forward, and what kind of birds are particularly affected by changes in those habitats in Ohio. You just heard from Michael Goldman. He's the conservation and outreach manager for the Grange Insurance Audubon Center in Columbus, and also with us by Skype, Nat Miller. He's acting executive director of Audubon Great Lakes and director of conservation for Audubon's Upper Mississippi Flyway. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The National Audubon Society released pretty grim projections for North American bird populations if global temperatures continue to rise. The temperature increases by 5.4 degrees. Nearly two-thirds of the birds in North America will go extinct by 2100. Still with us, Michael Goldman. He's conservation and outreach manager for Grange Insurance Audubon Center in Columbus. And Nat Miller by Skype, the acting executive director of Audubon Great Lakes and director of conservation for Audubon's Upper Mississippi Flyway. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Michael and Nat, I kind of want to just go through different kinds of habitats and what kind of birds are affected by the breakdown of those habitats due to climate change. And I thought we could start with grasslands and what kind of birds are most dependent on grasslands. We kind of were talking about that a little bit earlier. Michael Goldman?
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of different seed-eater birds that are really affected by whatever happens in the grasslands. I like thinking about the goldfinches. Goldfinches are a very common bird that we'll find here in Ohio. And they actually are one of the later breeding birds. And as far as birds go, a lot of them will breed in spring, but goldfinches are actually one that will, they're not breeding until May or June. Hmm. And they're relying on a lot of those later season seeds to feed their young with. So if we have something like a drought that's going on throughout Ohio, and those plants aren't able to produce those seeds for goldfinches, which again, very common species, we're going to see a huge decline in that population immediately, because that's when they are trying to feed their babies. Mm. And if their babies can't get food, then we don't have goldfinches next year.
And then, yeah, right. So, where you don't have another generation of goldfinches coming up, right, Nat Miller?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's every species is going to be impacted by climate change in some way, right? But I think our grassland birds especially are also impacted by a loss. It's that multiplier effect that was mentioned earlier, by the loss of habitat. We don't have very many grasslands and prairies left for these birds. So if they're being pushed out of those ranges, they're going to be hard. It's going to be hard for them to find new grasslands colonize.
Nat, you keep going.
Well, I was just going to say, one really cool feature of our new report is what we're calling the Bird and Climate Visualizer. Hmm. And I encourage you to go on to climate.audubon.org. And you can see every single species that we analyze, and you can also see it at the state level or even per your zip code. So you can type in your zip code, and it'll zoom on a map to the species that are there, show their current ranges, and then also show you their projected range shifts from climate change under different warming scenarios. So you can see that difference between the 2.7 degree warming and the 5.4 Fahrenheit.
We'll post that link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Let's see, Bob and Tiffin, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy the discussions that you guys have.
Thank you.
And
go ahead.
My question is that I hear people talk about climate change and attribute it to fossil fuels. I feel like I'm really in the middle of that, in the fact that in eastern Seneca County where I live, there are a couple wind turbine companies that want to install turbines. And there's a lot of opposition to that because they're worried that it's in the migratory path of the birds that come through Ohio. How do we get that balance of producing cleaner energy when there's so much opposition to progress when it comes to green technologies? And I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate that. Nat Miller, that's going on all over the place now, the debate over wind turbines, right?
Yeah, it's a really important discussion and question from the caller. I think, it's really important to recognize that we need wind energy as well as solar. We need a dramatic shift in our culture to get off of fossil fuels and greenhouse gas emissions. And wind, a lot of times from birders, there's a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction to wind energy because it does impact bird populations if it's in the wrong place. That said, if wind energy is properly sited with good science and evidence and good monitoring, then it's a great solution, great alternative to burning carbon.
There's been a huge controversy about siting wind turbines in Lake Erie or near Lake Erie in the path of the migrating birds that end up in McGee Marsh, that they watch at the Black Swamp Bird Observatory. Michael Goldman, I mean, I'm sure you've heard about that.
Yeah. And I was actually just up there a couple weeks ago for some birding myself. I'd have to agree with what Nat was saying. And if these wind turbines are in the right places and are properly managed, using science to make sure that they are away from where birds are going to be, then it's really not going to be as much of a problem as it would be otherwise. And really anything is going to be better than coal when it comes to birds and wildlife. Something I always think about when it comes to wind turbines is the wind goes oftentimes, west to east, but birds are migrating north to south. So wind turbines do some damage to birds, but I don't think it's as much as what some people may think.
Hmm. I mean, some people claim that house cats do more
house
damage.
House cats are much more damaging to birds. I love cats. I should say that. My mother has three cats. I love cats. I love keeping my cats inside. Or in a catio, if you are familiar with catios. It's a little outdoor enclosure that you can keep a cat in. That way you get some outdoor time, but it's still not going to be attacking the birds mm-hmm. and all the other little animals that might be living in your backyard.
Which kind of brings up a point that along the fringes, there are other things besides addressing climate change itself, Nat Miller. There are other things we need to do to preserve the birds we do have that are already here and already threatened by other things besides climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. At Audubon, we really have a two-prong approach that's coming out of this climate report. One is we need to take immediate action to curb greenhouse gases, right? We need to be carbon neutral by 2050 if we want to stay to that lower level warming scenario. And we need big political action to make that happen. It's not going to just be efficiencies at a local scale, although we're working on those as well. But we need state and federal policy, and we need to ask our elected officials to take action on that. That's first. Second, we know, science shows us that birds are being driven down by habitat loss and degradation. So we need to protect and restore and enhance those areas that are most important for birds. So that includes now and in the future with climate change, right? So programs like in Ohio, like H2 Ohio, a great new program that is investing in coastal wetlands that benefit the water quality of Lake Erie, but also protect great habitat, including a tremendous amount of migratory stopover habitat in the coastal areas of Lake Erie, are really important. There's a federal bill, Recovering America's Wildlife Act, which is in the House now, that would allow states to utilize federal fundings to keep common birds common. And a lot of those dollars will go into managing these areas on the ground that we know birds need. So those are the two things we can do that are most important on the biggest scale for birds.
You know, we talk about housing in Central Ohio and the housing market, and the builds are down partly as stemming from the recession, new builds and that kind of a thing. But all you have to do is look north of Franklin County, and it's still a shocking change just in the past 10 years. What, Michael Goldman, do we know about how that affects the birds that are going to wind up down at the Audubon Center, at Grange Insurance Audubon Center?
Well, it really is going to affect them. I agree with Nat. You know, habitat loss, habitat fragmentation is a huge problem when it comes to birds and a lot of other wildlife. Say you are a bird and you're in this large swath of forest, and you've been living here your whole life, and you can find all the little things that you need to survive. You can find your food and your water, safe place for your young, all within a 10-mile radius of your nest. Now, what happens if someone starts developing part of that land? Well, now you have to travel a little bit further to find all those little things. Now that's starting to take a lot of energy away from taking care of your young. Now you have to fly a little further away, and maybe there's a predator in the area that wants to come and find your nest. So this habitat fragmentation is really becoming a huge issue because you're not able to find all those things really close to your nest, close to your home. You're having to fly.
drive.
Yeah. These birds are driving everywhere. No, but they're having to fly further distances to get all those things that they need.
And they're meant not to have to do that.
They're not used to that. They haven't adapted to having to fly very, very far distances every single day. Usually they can find things in a couple of trees around them. But if you're building inside of those habitats, if you're logging these habitats, then they're going to have to fly a lot further to find all those things that they need to survive and to raise their young.
I wanted to touch on, if we can, a couple more habitats and what the breakdown means. What does the habitat change in the Arctic tundra have to do with what we see in Ohio or in the Midwest, Nat Miller?
Well, so the majority of our bird species are highly migratory, right? And that includes several species that are breeding in the Arctic and then migrate through the Midwest and Ohio and often even to Central and South America. So, you know, if the breeding conditions are not right for birds like the red knot, a shorebird, in the Arctic, or if changes in the boreal forest reduce the breeding success of our migratory warblers, the small songbirds, mm-hmm. of which we have almost 50 species, then we're going to lose those populations during the spring and fall. And we talked about the birding tourism. Birding tourism is really the biggest in the spring when we're watching all those migratory birds come through. Same with hunting in the fall, right? These are migratory birds. So what happens in the Arctic, and these are the birds that are most threatened in North America, of course, because they have no way to shift north. What happens to those birds affects the birds that we share coming through Ohio.
Yeah, and I think you make a really good point there, Nat. You know, these are birds that we're sharing. You know, they're not ours all year round. We share them with people up in Canada, and we're sharing them down as far down as Tierra del Fuego in Chile. Some birds, they're migrating huge distances to find all those things that they need. And Ohio being the warbler capital of the world, we need to have these warblers finding all the things they need up in the boreal forests, and they migrate through Ohio. We need to make sure that they're able to find all those things they need down in Central and South America as well.
Tell us about the boreal forests. What are those? Those are in...
The boreal forests are up in Canada. They're in the most northern, well, not the most northern part of Canada, but they are certainly up there. It's a lot of pine trees up there. So we're talking about a lot of birds that are relying on pine cones and the things that they're going to be able to find. Very cold northern areas. And I think it's so fascinating that these birds are able to survive in these large forests up there. But then they're also migrating through Ohio, and then they're living, you know, half their life down in Guatemala too, where they can also find all of these things that they need to survive. I mean, how incredible is that? They can find everything they need in the boreal forests all the way down to the beaches of Guatemala.
Yeah, it is amazing. It is amazing. What about arid lands? That now we know Westerville is going through a drought, a suburb of Columbus here. But do we have anything in common with? Do we share birds with, say, Arizona and Colorado and New Mexico that way? Nat Miller.
There's a pretty natural divide, the continental divide in the United States with the Rocky Mountains that separates to the most extent eastern and western populations of birds. So when you buy a bird guide, you often get, in our neck of the woods, you get an eastern guide. That said, we do share some species, and we certainly share some of the impacts that are happening out west. So just like here, extreme spring heat, fall springs, drought periods of drought. You know, one interesting thing from Ohio is while we're going to see more precipitation overall, we're also going to experience significant periods of drought and have lower moisture really because of that more extreme evaporation. So, you know, I think we're going to see more commonality. Wildfires are certainly a big factor out west that's associated with climate change and another direct threat on birds and people.
And then what about the impact of severe storms? We were talking earlier with the climatologist about that the storms are getting fiercer. They're dropping more rain. They're more destructive now. Have we seen that here? Michael Goldman, I remember when Hurricane, I think it was Ike, came through Columbus and tore down thousands of trees probably.
Yeah, and it's not just about the intensity of these storms and how much precipitation that they're dropping on us. It also has to do with how often that they're happening now.
Yeah.
Birds might have been able to adapt to having one big storm come in through a year, and they're fine. But now if it's three or four or five big storms coming through, that could really have a terrible effect on their populations, especially if it's during a breeding time. Because those babies, they are defenseless against all kinds of things. The adults might be fine, but those little baby birds are going to have a lot of trouble. And I think with all these hurricanes in the Atlantic, we're finding that some birds will colonize a whole island during their breeding period. But if a big storm comes through, it could wipe out a whole flock of birds.
And there's another big nor'easter heading up the East Coast again, even as we speak. Michael Goldman, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Michael Goldman is Conservation and Outreach Manager for the Grange Insurance Audubon Center. And Nat Miller, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Nat Miller is the Acting Executive Director of Audubon Great Lakes and Director of Conservation for Audubon's Upper Mississippi Flyway. Thanks to the All-Site staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, our interns Atiyah Ture, Tatiana Woodall, and Bobby Gerberic, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks to Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me too at Ann Fisher WOSU.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.